Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling precise.
Oh.
Because today's guest is pretty much the most rigorous, grounded, profoundly important, in my opinion, but also in many people's opinion. I think his work is incredibly significant and will actually live on long past all of our existences and hopefully continue to bring change.
That's heavy. This is heavy.
Thought-provoking.
Our guest is actually laughing. This is
well,
very
I
heavy
know.
Stuff.
Well, you know me, I'm Mr. Ernest. And, you know, the show we're here to talk about today is currently just opened at the New Museum in the wonderful place of New York, which I miss terribly, but we will get back there one day. And the show is called Grief and Grievance. So there is a reason that I'm being quite earnest and serious, but also I do believe his work is great. And he's an artist that without doubt is making us think about things differently and bringing about social change. And it's also, I would like to remember today the amazing work of the curator Okwi Enweze, who sadly passed away in 2019 and was the kind of thought, the kind of
catalyst.
Brain behind this show and the catalyst. So that's another reason to be serious. But you can also have joy and humour and happiness, which is what we will bring to this episode. But we would like to welcome to Talk Art someone we've wanted to interview for a long time, Mr. Glenn Ligon. Hi, Glenn.
Thank you. Hi, Robert, Russell. Thank you. Delighted to be on the podcast, finally. delighted to be talking about this exhibition.
Where are you today?
I'm in my studio in Brooklyn, on semi-lockdown, you know, just go home, come to the studio, go home, you know?
Yeah, it's like a repetition, isn't it? A lot of repetition lately, but
Do you go to the studio every day? Is that part of your, like, routine?
I try to go every day, but some days you just can't.
because of lockdown or just because of
you just want to lie on your couch all day, you know, and think. I mean, the irony is that this various, you know, New York City isn't on an official lockdown, but it just feels safer to kind of limit one's activities, you know, to me. Until more people are vaccinated. But it in a strange way, because there's so little that people want to do in public or want to do together, you have a lot of time alone. But I don't want to spend every minute of it in the studio, you know.
Got
I don't think that's productive either. So
yeah. But do you have a distinction, like if you're at home, that's not work, that's home, and then the studio's work. Have you set yourself them like parameters?
Oh, it's a Kinsey scale, you know, making stuff on the computer. And I was like, oh, I wasn't supposed to be working today, but I guess I am because I'm thinking about something and playing around on Photoshop on the computer or whatever, you know. And then sometimes I get to the studio and there's endless hours on home decorating websites. You know, home porn, as I call it.
Oh, yeah. Architectural Digest, AD Online. My God, I agree with you. But also,
Russell definitely shares that with you.
You're a voracious reader. So that also, in some ways, is like pays into your practice, is research for you, because you mine and cull literature and quotes from literature throughout all of your work from the 80s onwards. So I guess if you're at home on the couch, you're also reading a book, right?
I want to say yes. really want to say yes. And sometimes that is true, but most often it's Netflix and, you know, Amazon Prime and, you know, Hulu.
Yeah, and Downton Abbey and reruns, which I've heard you're a massive fan of.
Downton Abbey reruns, yes.
Well, let's talk about the new museum show, which you're involved in at the minute, which is, you know, it all comes, it feels like you were kind of there to, you know, secure its continuity after what Rob introduced about the curator who passed, sadly, last year. But it felt like your involvement at that stage really did continue his message that he wanted to do. Can we talk a bit about this amazing show? And we've got this incredible publication in front of us as well for it.
Right. I'm really grateful the publication has come out and the show was delayed. It was actually supposed to open during the last presidential election, but delayed for COVID. So it's just open about a week or two ago in New York, but the publication was out beforehand. And I met Okwien Wazer, the curator who thought of this exhibition in, I think, 1998. We were on a panel together about God knows what, but whatever the topic was, Opie wasn't talking about it anyway. So he just talked about the, you know, the archive and the reception of artists from Africa and the global South, and he was mesmerizing. And so that was my first meeting with him, and we stayed in touch. And he became, you know, the curator, the amazing curator he was soon after that, you know, with a string of exhibitions, both in the United States and internationally. Mm-hmm. So I guess in fall of 2018, Okwie called me up and said, I'm working on this exhibition for the new museum. I would love for you to be my kind of interlocutor, be the person I bounce ideas off of. And at the moment, he was the director of the Haus der Kunst in Munich and had full exhibition schedule there, but really thought this show, Grief and Grievance, was a show for America. And he had been in dialogue with the new museum for probably a year before he told me about this show with the curator there, chief curator Massimiliano Giorni. And so that was my role. I was someone to bounce off ideas off of outside of his relationship to Massimiliano. But at the time, Okwie was being treated for cancer. And I don't think I realized how ill he was. So we began this dialogue, and he was at the same time curating shows for the Haus der Kunst and getting treatment for his cancer. And I went to see him in Munich in early March of 2019, and he literally, you know, received me in his hospital bed. As I was walking in, he was being wheeled out on this stretcher. It's like, Glenn, he has a very, very distinctive voice and accent and way of talking. And I can't really do it, but Glenn, I'll be right back. I have this little treatment. And of course, it was a radiation treatment. And half an hour later, he was back, and we spent the next 6 or 7 hours at his bedside talking about this exhibition.
Wow. Well, this exhibition contains 37 artists, all working across different mediums, addressing the concept of mourning, commemoration, and loss as a direct response to the national emergency of racist violence that's expressed to Black communities across America.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So it's a subject that I think he'd been thinking about for a long time. Okwie spent a lot of time in the United States, a lot of time in New York. He had many artist friends here. He raised a daughter in New York. So I think he was deeply invested in what was going on here politically, what artist friends were thinking about in the United States. So even though he was in Germany at the time, he was deeply invested in American culture. And I think prescient, could see kind of where things were going, you know, before the arrival of Trump, but certainly was thinking about, you know, this sort of spectacle of Black death that was happening on greater and greater frequency through from, you know, the election of Trump onward. And so this exhibition, I think, came out of thinking about those issues and talking to artists, too. Exhibitions come out of artworks and artists. They don't come the other way around, you know? Mm. Most people think, you know, a curator has an idea for a show and they just plug artists into that idea. But it's really the other way around. The curator's thinking about what artists are making and then formulating their ideas about the topic of the show from what he's seeing in the field, from what artists are thinking about, what they're telling him about.
It's really interesting to think about that, actually, because I think the importance of listening to artists and also just generally as human beings to each other is such a key and important, you know, thing. And I think sometimes people forget about it because it's such an important one. And I think doing this podcast for us, we've learned about, you know, listening. But how important is that within your own practice? Because if you think of the work that's currently on the facade of the new museum currently, which you showed for the first time in 2015, I think that was the year you made it, called A Small Band. And it was also curated at the time by the same curator. So it's like a continuation of that connection too.
But I know it's Biennale, wasn't it?
The Venice Biennale, yeah. It was the Italian Pavilion, yeah. And I know that this is the first time you're showing that work in New York, which is your home and also is significant politically. Can you speak a bit about the idea of listening and that new work?
Well, it's sort of interesting to talk about the idea of listening because that piece really came about in many ways by listening. First, listening to Steve Reich, whose composition Come Out from the mid-60s, I'm forgetting the exact date now, was a response to him listening to testimony from Black teenagers who were beaten in Harlem in the early 60s. And making this composition called Come Out, using their actual testimony, particularly of this kid named Daniel Hamm, and making a tape loop where he's repeating something Daniel Hamm says over and over again. In 1964, there was a disturbance in Harlem, and the police picked up these Black teenagers, and one of them was taken to the police station and beaten, and sort of left in his cell, but he was hurt and needed to go to a doctor. Mm. So he says what he did was he opened up his bruise to let some of the bruised blood come out to show them that he was hurt. But when you listen to his testimony, which was recorded later, he makes a little slip of the tongue. Instead of saying bruised blood, he says blues blood. Mm. So, but I didn't know any of this story. When I first listened to Steve Reich, the amazing composer, he uses this testimony to make this composition called Come Out. So a very, very famous composition in minimal music where it's basically two tape loops playing at the same time. They get out of sync. And so this phrase, come out to show them. I had to open up, you know, the bruise to let some of the bruised blood come out to show them. Mm-hmm. And he narrows his composition down to the words come out. But it's on two tape loops, and he plays them simultaneously, and they get slightly out of sync. And so it becomes this incredibly repetitious patterning of this come out to show them, come out to show them, come out to show them. And then it's doubled, and then it's quadrupled, and so it becomes this sort of noise at the end of the composition. So I'd heard that composition for many, many years without understanding that, you know, the testimony in it, you know, the tape loop itself is based on this very famous, you know, episode in Harlem in 1964. But in a weird way, Reich's piece, you know, is more famous than the episode that inspired it. Right. And so I started to go back and sort of, you know, do some research and found this story about Daniel Hamm and him saying, you know, I had to open up the bruise to let some of the bruised blood come out to show them. But then I realized, like, oh, he doesn't say bruised blood. He says blues blood. There's a slip of the tongue. And I began thinking about how the blues and bruising and blood become these, like, conjoined terms, you know. Ralph Ellison once said the blues was personal catastrophe expressed lyrically. Mm. So the idea of pain and suffering is caught up in the blues. And so that sort of slip of the tongue that Daniel Hamm makes, I think, was really interesting and inspired this piece that has the words in it, you know, blues, blood, bruise. And they blink off and on, sometimes together, sometimes separately, in this sort of pattern, like a small band, these three words playing with each other, playing off of each other. But the listening part is interesting because, so that's one sense that I was listening. But another part was that, you know, when I first was starting to make neon work using these words, I made a piece that was similar to it that was shown at Camden Arts Centre in London.
Right.
And Oakley saw that show and spent a lot of time in the room where this piece was installed and said, "Glenn, can your neons be outside?" And I didn't know what he meant by that. I was like, well, yeah, neon can be outside, you know, walk down the street, lots of neons outside. But what he meant was, can it be outside on the facade of the main building in the Venice Biennale? That's what he meant, you know? And to do that meant that I would make a piece that would be the biggest piece I'd ever made in my career. And so really it was listening to Oakley's ambition for me as an artist that caused me to make this piece, you know, sort of him saying, like, you need to make a big piece and it needs to be on the front facade of the Italian Pavilion in the Giardini for the Biennale, you know. Oakley's ambition for me, you know, and often
I say to
a friend that, you know, Oakley sometimes is more ambitious for one as an artist than you were for yourself sometimes.
Wow. You know? That's a wonderful
thing.
This
amazing ability to bring out the best in artists, to give them this opportunity. I mean, of course, he wanted a giant piece for his show. That was a win-win for him, but he also saw this potential. A potential that I frankly hadn't seen, you know? And so that's how that piece came about.
It's interesting, that idea of potential, because if you think about the resulting work, so it's now, you know, on the facade of the new museum in New York, and people are walking on the street, staring up, and they see it. Like, it does, it's the kind of work that you're immediately going to think, what is that about, maybe? Mm. You know, once you've kind of, you look at it maybe as a poetic statement, then you might see it as light or words, and then you might think, what is it about? So in the sense that it's provoking thought, and also will hopefully make people research the story that you're referencing. How important is that within your work? You know, if you think of Steve Reich's audio piece being more famous than the story of Daniel, like, is that something that you've always sort of considered, like the longevity of the work and the meanings behind it?
Well, I think that, you know, a lot of the work is generated by thinking about texts that have at some point been lost to history. So, for example, I use a lot of texts by a writer of the Harlem Renaissance, Zora Neale Hurston. Mm-hmm. She was buried in an unmarked grave, you know. So imagine that, you know, one of the most famous writers of the 30s, 40s, 50s, friends with Langston Hughes, and, you know, buried in an unmarked grave. You know,
why was that? Because of poverty or because of...
Her work had gone out of fashion, out of print. She wasn't making money. She needed to be rediscovered. And so, you know, a writer like Alice Walker rediscovered her, you know, Black studies, you know, Black literature rediscovered her in the 70s and 80s. And so now Zora Neale Hurston is crucial again, you know. You could say the same thing with Baldwin. You know, Baldwin's very, very, you know, people think we quote Baldwin all the time, James Baldwin, the writer. He's an amazing writer, wrote brilliantly about many, many different subjects. But in the 70s, you know, Baldwin was out of favor, you know. People weren't listening to him as much. He was too nuanced, you know, too gay.
Yeah.
That work had to be rediscovered in a sense. So I'm always drawn to these things that have a second or third life, you know, or by using them, I'm trying to give them a second and third life. But I must say that, you know, when I do lectures sometimes and, you know, I'm talking to young art students and they give me blank looks, and I thought, you know, use your external hard drive. It's called Google, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But what you're doing by drawing these figures of literature and highlighting sections of their writing, you're really bringing information to that work. I mean, I've discovered so much through your work, but you've just mentioned James Baldwin, but like Ralph Ellison, Richard Pryor, Gertrude Stein, words that they've spoken, things that they've said that you've then taken and appropriated into your paintings and drawings and video works is highlights to me stuff, information that I had no idea of or just was completely unaware of. And that in you're educating and highlighting things that are so important effortlessly through your artwork.
Well, I'm flattered you say that, but so much effort. It's a big dumpster.
Does it feel like it, right?
Yeah. With a lot of bad work in it, you know? Ready right. Bonfire. So, but I think also, you know, as well as highlighting things, I think there's a sense that sometimes you use text to interrogate things, you know. Gertrude Stein, you know, using a phrase from one of her novels called Three Lives. So I use a little phrase that called Negro Sunshine. But if you read that text, you know, the black character that Stein is talking about, it's brutal. It has no love for black people, you know? So extracting those two words, Negro Sunshine, from the context of that novel is a sort of reclamation act, you know? It's sort of reading against Stein's, you know, depiction of black humanity in that novel. So sometimes it's not about celebrating, but also critiquing, you know?
And this was a big neon that ended up at the Whitney as well, wasn't it?
It was in my Whitney retrospective show, and it's been shown a lot. Yeah,
there's been like four versions of it, haven't there? Four different incantations
exactly.
of it. Yeah,
exactly.
But there was a New York Times. I've read a New York Times interview you did, and they asked you, did you put that phrase up to shock? And you responded, shock. It's not provocative. It's Gertrude Stein.
Well, I was being cheeky.
Yeah, no, I love that though because
I didn't like the question. you know, because it's often asked of artists of color, is your work meant to be provocative? Like, no, my work is my work. My work is meant to ask questions, to provoke dialogues, you know. Jeff Koons is shocking, you know.
Yes, there's sections of that. Yes, the porn photos are shocking.
Yeah, porn photos. I'll leave that to him. You know?
Yeah. It's interesting when you think of like the show you did in LA when you looked at Robert Mapplethorpe's photography, and then you kind of recontextualized that in a way and brought up questions that a lot of people hadn't even considered or had the time to think about by also looking at what other people had said and critiqued his work. I do find it quite really fascinating because that was an eye-opener to me because I'd never seen a lot of those photos even, you know, that whole series that he'd made.
Well, there's two practices, two parts of your work that really inspire me. And the first one I wanted to talk about was an earlier work, which was called, from a show called To Disembark.
Right.
Which was one that I when I was researching today, came across and I thought it was just incredible about Henry Box Brown, who was a slave who escaped in a crate, and then you created from that this installation of nine crates, and they apparently when he was found he was escaping and he was singing when he was found, and you created these nine crates and there was music in two of the crates, and then there were sounds of bird song and like breeze in another one, but the songs you chose was Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit and then Sound of the Police KRS-One, and I the juxtaposition of those two. Can you talk a bit about that installation, because that's something that I would love to see, and where is that now?
Right. Well, yeah, I got really interested in Henry Box Brown's story because I saw an image of a lithograph of Henry Box Brown being liberated from this crate. And I didn't know anything about the story, you know, but I just saw this image and I thought, what is this? And so I read his narrative, his autobiography, and it turns out he was a captive and worked in a tobacco factory in Richmond, Virginia, and became friends with a white carpenter who also worked in Richmond. And thought of the scheme to escape slavery to ask this carpenter to build a crate and nail him inside of it and mail it to an anti-slavery society in Philadelphia. So we're talking about, you know, a sort of 3.5 by 3 by 2 foot crate, something like that, you know, being mailed, you know, literally. But, you know, mailing in the mid 1800s meant, you know, wagon, boat, yeah. You know.
Yeah.
That's what mailing meant. So he was inside this crate for, I think, 30 hours, and it was mailed to an anti-slavery society in Philadelphia, and they opened the crate. And Henry says the first thing he thought of to do was to sing at his sort of resurrection, his release from this grave of a crate that he was encased in. And I was really interested in the idea that the idea of music and song and singing was the first thing that came to him, and thinking about how important music has been to the African-American experience, you know. I won't get the exact quote right, but the amazing Arthur Jaffa, the filmmaker, says that he wants to make videos that have as much majesty and brilliance as Black music, you know, that Black music is for him the sort of pinnacle expression of African-American culture. And so I was thinking about, you know, Henry Box Brown in this Coming to Voice. And so I made these 9 crates, and each of them had a different soundtrack in them. Yeah. One was, you know, Henry's narrative being read. One was KRS-One, Sound of the Police, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's sort of the idea that, you know, when most people I'd seen who'd done installations or work about slavery sort of put it in the past, you know, it was this terrible thing that happened many, many, many decades ago, you know, centuries ago. And I wanted to think about it as something that's not just events in the past, but something that structures American democracy. It is there when we're writing our Constitution. Mm. It is there when our laws are being formed. So it is, you know, it structures the way we live now. It's we are in its wake, you know. And so to think about slavery is something that, you know, KRS-One is singing about, Barb Marley is singing about, Billie Holiday is singing about, you know, her song is Strange Fruit. It's about lynching, but that lynching comes out of slavery, you know, the idea that Black lives are expendable, that Black lives have no meaning, don't matter. You can randomly use people up and then kill them, you know? So that's what I was thinking about. How do you bring the idea that slavery is in the present?
Do we know what happened to him? Did he, like, blossom in Philadelphia and have a great life? And
well, I, you know, the interesting thing about him is that he made his living doing recreations of his escape from slavery.
Right. Wow.
Think about that for a second.
So it's like he can never escape.
A trauma.
Just like never, yeah.
Yeah. You know, so besides him, you know, he wrote his autobiography, but he also went around the country doing these reenactments of his bondage and his freedom.
Wow.
Wow. See, that story is one that I've, you know, that's really important and fascinating and historical, and I've learned that through your work. But the other body of work that's really affected me is the children's colouring books.
Yes,
and how amazing. You went to schools and you gave them these children's colouring books, and they had images of Malcolm X in, but they weren't wed to any sort of identity politics or any of the discourse about, you know, racism and history. They just took these colouring pictures as something that they could fill in, you know, and try not to go over the edges of with coloured pencils.
Yeah, or like queering the father figure. Just like beyond.
I mean, and one of them even asked you, are you Malcolm X? It was like they went to it with such an innocence that really inspired a whole body of work for you. How did you come up with that concept?
Well, I had a residency at the Walker Arts Museum in Minneapolis. And this was maybe, oh God, I'm not even remembering when that was, maybe mid-90s, something like that, or 2000. Mm-hmm. And one of the the rules around the residency was you had to work with communities within a 3-mile radius of the museum itself. And Minneapolis is a city with very, very diverse city. Lots of different kinds of people from all over the world have settled there. But I thought, well, I don't want to sort of say, you know, work with, say, you know, refugees from Somalia. I want to define community as, you know, kids. What if I work with kids and define that as the community I was going to work with? And how was I going to work with them? Well, I decided to thought, well, you know, kids love to color, so maybe something about coloring. And at first I was going to, you know, give them images from, I think it was like Rugrats. Remember that?
Yeah, of course.
The love cartoon. Rugrats. There were all these coloring books out, you know, Star Wars and Rugrats, you know, coloring books that I found. And I thought, no, that's too stupid. I can't do that. So I did some research. I went to a library and found these images of 1970s coloring books, so late 60s, early 70s. And they were done by Black educators. And what was interesting about them was it's at the moment when there are debates around how to teach African-American history to young kids, you know, young kids color. So why don't you give them images that depict, you know, things that would be in a child's coloring book, you know, a boy swinging on a tire or, you know, a girl combing her hair. Juxtapose that with heroes from Black history, Harriet Tubman, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, you know. But if you think about it, an image of Malcolm X in a children's coloring book in 1968 is kind of quite radical, you know. This is old Malcolm X, you know, like Malcolm X, who was like called the most dangerous man in America, Malcolm X, not the Malcolm X we can buy at the post office and on postage stamps, you know. So this sense of like this radical project that these Black educators had to introduce these sort of new, you know, superheroes to kids through these coloring books was super interesting to me. So I gave those images to these kids that I met through daycare centers, after school centers in the Minneapolis area. But I realized that, you know, for these kids, they're just images. You know, they didn't know who Malcolm X was or Martin Luther King, you know, 4 or 5 year old, you know. So, of course, they're like, you see a guy with glasses. And, oh, is that you? It's like, no, baby, that's Malcolm X. But your drawing with the lipstick and eyeshadow is kind of amazing. So I took those images the kids made and showed them at the art museum, along with paintings I made based on their images. So it was almost like, you know, kind of commissioning my own source material in a way.
Yeah. But it sort of freed you, well, they were freed of the concerns, but it freed you of the concerns. But did you know when you were seeing them that they were going to inspire a whole new body of work? That also was the first time the representational figure appears in your practice.
No, I didn't know that, but it made sense that I was using images that someone else had drawn, you know, the coloring book images, and then making paintings using the way the kids had drawn on those images. So it, in some sense, you know, because my practice is all about quotation, using someone else's text, using someone else's image, commenting on Mapplethorpe's image, etc. You know, so the idea of like, okay, I'm not going to make drawings of Malcolm X to give to kids to color. There are already images out there. So why don't we use the images that exist already with all the political intentions behind the original, and give them to the kids and see what they do with them. Uh-oh, this kid has drawn lipstick on Malcolm X. I know what that means. He doesn't know what that means.
Yeah.
And so it was about, in a way, the gulf between one historic moment and another, you know, kind of what I knew Malcolm X to be and how important his image was and what those original comic books were about versus now, you know, like, how do we process those images now? What does Malcolm X mean now? You know, icons, you know, someone says in an essay about the great Wayne Kostenbaum says, you know, icons are there to be made over and over again, you know, so each generation finds a Malcolm X, they remake them, you know, so that's what that work was about. And there were other images besides Malcolm X. There were Harriet Tubman images, there were Frederick Douglass images, and there were you know, boy swinging on tire.
Yeah, yeah, totally. But they have like an Andy Warhol Basquiat feel to them as well.
Yeah, I am so not Basquiat though. You know, Basquiat really paint and I just copy. You know, I just had to learn how to, you know, do kids drawing as well as a kid could do it, you know, and that's hard work, you know.
There's an incredible Basquiat in the new museum show at the moment, which I've never actually seen before. That's really incredibly moving. Yeah. Where is it? What collection was that from, and how did you guys come up with that?
I've actually seen it at a group show at Jack Shaman Gallery. And it was just stuck with me, you know. So when we were thinking about Grief and Grievance, Basquiat was high on Oakley's list of an artist he wanted to include in it. And there was a particular painting he was interested in, which was about Michael Stewart, the death of Michael Stewart, who was a graffiti artist in New York who was basically beaten to death by the cops. So we know that this story is not new. And Basquiat knew him and made a painting of Michael Stewart. But that painting had been shown in a sort of well-known show at the Guggenheim the year before. So we decided to not show that again in Grief and Grievance. But I just remembered, you know, having seen that Basquiat painting, that that might be a great substitute. So that's kind of where it came from.
It's an incredible work. So Basquiat is a hero of yours. Is Andy Warhol? Because I know that Robert Rauschenberg is as well.
Yeah, Rauschenberg. I'm actually on the board of the Rauschenberg Foundation now. So. Oh, wow. Warhol, certainly. Basquiat, David Hammonds. I mean, lots of heroes. Yeah.
Yeah, and I heard that in 87 you saw a Warhol show of his shadow paintings, and that you at the time hadn't quite consciously understood what they meant to you, but they kind of always resonated in your mind. Can you speak a bit about the impact of
well,
that?
Well, I think it was, it was in Soho in New York, and there were many firsts on that day. It's the first time I saw Warhol's shadow paintings, the first time I had brown rice.
Really?
Tahini.
Wow.
I love the fact that you remember
away
that.
From the South Bronx. We didn't have no brown rice.
Right.
All right. So yeah, that was a sort of formative moment. And you know, what's interesting is sometimes you see things and you don't know what you're looking at and you don't get it, but they stay with you. And that's one of those shows that really, really stayed with me. Maybe because it was such a huge installation. And it's up right now at Dia Art Center in Beacon, New York.
What is the work like, the shadow work?
They're basically, you know, Warhol had one of his assistants take a couple of photos of shadows of something. Now, there's many speculations about what they're shadows of. Some say it's just a construction of blocks and things. Some say it's a shadow of an erect penis, you know. Mm-hmm. I like that.
Lovely. Yeah, I like that idea as well, yeah.
But anyway.
That's a lovely shadow.
It's a lovely shadow. moving on. So the paintings are literally of this shadow, but a shadow is a thing, you know, so they look like abstract paintings, but they're paintings of this thing, which is a shadow. So that sort of back and forth between representation and abstraction is super interesting. But also Warhol takes these images and gives each painting a different color background. So they're pink backgrounds or purple backgrounds or gold backgrounds or and so you see, when you see the installation, this incredible line of, you know, dozens and dozens of these paintings of I think two or three images of shadows, but across, like, you know, 90 paintings. And they're spectacular. I mean, Warhol said they were disco decor, you know? It's like, and they're very, so like, good. They're very sexy and very beautiful colors, and, you know, they're very attractive paintings, but conceptually they're super, super interesting. Like,
yeah. Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And the shadow plays into your work because of the neons. I feel like whenever I see your neons, especially America, which is up at the Whitney, when you go and buy your ticket for the Whitney, it's literally behind the registers there. But the shadow that the neon creates, or the space behind the neon, or the way that conceptually that works, it feels like the shadow is as important as what we are first assuming is the neon, right? We're told to see.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always interested in, eclipse light. That's kind of where this has all come from. And there's a sort of funny origin story about all of my neons, which is the neon guy that makes all my neons, he had a studio in the same building that I'm in, where my studio currently is. And I walked by his shop every day because he's on the ground floor and just, you know, hi, wave, you know, but I don't make neon, you know. So I'd walk by his shop. This went on for 2 or 3 years. And one day he was just outside doing something. He's like, oh, you want to come in and have a look around? And I'm like, yeah, sure. But I don't make neon, you know. I'll come look around. So he's showing me the stuff that he makes. And he makes a lot of different kinds of things. He makes work for artists, but he also makes work for commercial things like, you know, Disney or Apple or whatever. So they were working on a piece for Burberry's, a window display, and it was stripes. And, you know, Burberry's plaid has a black stripe in it. And he said, oh, there's an interesting story behind that, because the art director said, okay, we want, you know, our plaid in neon. And Matt said, well, there's a black stripe. Black is the absence of light. And the art director said, that's not my problem. You figured that out. And what Matt did was take a white neon tube and just paint it black on the front. So it reads as a black line, but also reads as white neon, because the light is coming out from behind. So when he showed me the mock-up for that, you know, Burberry sign, and started talking about this black light, I thought, oh, we are so ready to go, you know?
Yeah.
And that's where the Negro Sunshine came from, you know, white neon tubes painted black on the front. So they're both black and white at the same time. The light comes out the back. Mm-hmm. But they're also kind of in shadow, eclipsed, because you see that black line. So a lot of my work came out of that kind of funny, you know,
exchange.
Black is the absence of light. You know, what about black neon? I remember saying to Matt, and he told me this story, and I thought, wow.
He must love you now. He must be like, result.
We've been together for 20 years, so I guess.
Wow.
I always remember seeing your paintings as well, and with the glitter on them, and then how they reflect. And I remember being really struck by them without even knowing the context of what the meaning is behind the work, if that makes sense.
Just the texture,
like more on a kind of like wonder level, like on a kind of I remember feeling a kind of joy, like looking at them, because they are so pleasing,
right,
in a way. And and it's an interesting illusion it creates in a sense, because it's a bit like what Russ was talking about, the way it can all appear like it's effortless, but in fact it's not. It's this ongoing, you know, rigorous kind of exploration into it all. But like I think that is quite interesting, the way that your work has that kind of element of joy in it that people can access, if you know what I mean.
Well, I always find it's like you're unawares what you're being told. It's like there's a narrative in there, there's a story in there, there's history. I always think of like David Wojnarowicz when he did his stencils, is that like the burning house. You see the burning house, and it's all ended up on, like, we had it as a flyer for our show we was doing last year on Broadway, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, but it was on apparel, it's on pencil cases, but you don't realise that what you're actually witnessing is a piece of gay history, is a piece of queer, like, authentic life lived. But it's kind of like a Trojan horse. It gets in there and you don't realise. And that's what I'm saying about, we're saying about your work, and everybody, like, that's why your work is so important, because it is like this Trojan horse, is that you're seeing something very beautiful and then you realize the connotations behind it.
Well, I think beauty is always a hook for me. You know, it's the first thing that engages someone is, you know, when I go into a museum, I'm attracted to beautiful things, you know, I just go. And then the meaning later on, you know, and I, you know, what I think is beautiful is different than what other people think are beautiful. You know, I think Donald Judds are beautiful because they're precise, yes. You know, other people just see like, you know, it's just a piece of metal, you know, shaped into a box, you know, but there's a kind of precision and rigor about that that I find quite beautiful, you know. But I also like Basquiat was an amazing, amazing painter, you know, just stand in front of also, I guess also, you know, like sometimes he made ugly things too, you know, that's super interesting that what, you know, we used to consider ugly is now quite beautiful. De Kooning's, think about like de Kooning paintings, you know. When they first started showing in the 50s, I'm sure people were like, what is all this ugly stuff? What's ugly?
Pollock. Yeah. Pollock made people so angry. It still does make people angry. But you started off painting like abstract expressionists. Yeah. That's how you first started. Well, actually, when you first started, you started doing pottery classes as a kid. Can we go that far back? That was your first access into the art world.
In the South Bronx.
Oh, yeah. Well, those pottery classes were in Greenwich Village. So, you know, I got to go after school. Yeah, that was the funny thing. My mom was, you know, her famous line to me was, you know, why you want to be an artist? All the artists I know of are dead, you know?
Yeah.
And she meant Picasso and Matisse. Like, well, yes, in fact, they are dead. It's true, you know, but I still want to be an artist. And if you didn't want me to be an artist, then why'd you send me the pottery classes in Greenwich Village and after school drawing classes at the Metropolitan Museum. You know, this was a single mother, you know, we were living in the South Bronx, but she thought that learning about art made you a good citizen. And so she, you know, doled out this money for me to go have art experiences, even though the idea of me actually wanting to be an artist was kind of bizarre to her, you know. But
and she saw you succeed. She saw you like have museum shows. Wow.
Yeah. So,
and she was right.
You know,
not about the dead art. About art making you a good citizen.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think there is a connection between art and citizenship. I have a good friend, Stephen Andrews, a dear painter friend of mine. And he says, you know, I often call myself a citizen because when I call myself an artist, people don't know what that means. But when I call myself a citizen who uses one's art to express one's citizenship-ness, you know, think about what it means to be a citizen through the art, then people understand what I mean, you know. Artists have this role, you know, in society, you know, to look at it carefully and express stuff about it and express difficult stuff about it often, you know, as well as beautiful things, you know.
I really like this idea of you growing up in the Bronx as well and being surrounded by kind of culture everywhere you looked, like in the sense of things that people didn't necessarily think were culture because they weren't somehow highbrow enough or something because they were on the walls of trains or, you know, or on street corners like graffiti and how I never even knew this artist, but Lady Pink, the American graffiti artist, who's just extraordinary. And I've spent a lot of time today looking at her work and I'd never seen it before, but like, and how that subconsciously has influenced your interest in text and also like obviously music that you were surrounded by just growing up. Like the importance of all of that.
Right. Well. Except that my mama was not letting me outside with those hoodlums. I'm sorry. You know, what was her line? Out there scratching up perfectly good records. And what she meant was like, you know, African Bambaataa playing in the parking lot downstairs, like scratching up perfectly good records. You're not going outside.
Wow.
It's sort of like the idea that the streets were dangerous, but you know, I grew up in the South Bronx. This is where it was all happening, you know, but in some ways I wasn't allowed, you know, quote unquote, to be out there because she was trying to like get me up out of there rather than like realizing like, no, that's where it was. So when people ask me like, oh my God, you grew up in the South Bronx? And I was like, yeah, I missed it.
I heard
it.
You know, when did you first like witness Richard Pryor, because his words have played into your text pieces. He's had a video work that you've made of him. He feels very important to you.
Oh, I first heard it because I had older cousins. And so I had cousins that lived in D.C., Washington, D.C. My grandparents lived there. And so when we go every summer, my brother and I, to visit my cousins, you know, because they were older, they had their own money. So they could buy whatever albums they wanted to. So we would get our cousins to play the Richard Pryor records that my mother wouldn't let me buy, because Richard Pryor was too nasty and too grown and all those curse words and no, you know. So we'd go up to my cousin's bedroom and put the stereo on real low. So the adults wouldn't hear, you know, the adults were downstairs drinking or whatever they were doing. And we put on the Richard Pryor. So I must have been, you know, 13, 14 listening to Richard Pryor records. And they were too grown, too nasty, but he made a huge impression on me, you know.
When did it enter your work?
It entered my work, I think, in the early 90s, you know, making joke paintings. Because I just loved, you know, I loved his speech, you know, like, because you were listening to a comedy album, you were listening to someone talk, you know. And so I got really interested in the idea of, instead of quoting literature, you know, Zora Neale Hurston, Toni Morrison, et cetera, why not quote speech, you know? Why not put speech into the painting? So that was one of the, you know, sort of things that I was interested in, making joke paintings using Richard Pryor jokes. But also those jokes were like, they're deeply political and funny, you know, at the same time, you know? And they were full of words you couldn't really say, put in public spaces, like, you know, the N word and the B word and, you know, all the all the letter words. You know?
Yeah, but you stenciled these onto, and the stenciling has been through a constant throughout your practice. You never really see your own handwriting. It's always kind of the stenciled letter. But you would stencil these jokes onto kind of really beautiful gold canvas. So again, it has this kind of appealing quality to it where you want to go close to it. And then you do read the jokes, and some people must have been, you know, taken affront by that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I remember showing in Thelma Golden's exhibition Blackmail, which is at the really important exhibition at the Whitney Museum in 1994. And we had a couple of Richard Pryor joke paintings in there. And I had a friend who was working as a museum guide, and he was doing a tour, and the paintings aren't so big, and he had a big group, and not all of them could see what he was talking about. And, you know, being a good art historian, he was talking about issues of narration and voice and text as art. And from the back, he said someone started saying, "Read the joke," because they couldn't literally, you know, see what.
See it. Yeah.
But the joke has the N-word in it. And Richard, my friend, was white, didn't feel comfortable reading the joke. But it kept coming up, "Read the joke." And the audience was like a lot of black folks, because the show was called Blackmail. So it had a black audience. And finally, he said someone came to the front and kind of shoved him to the side, read the joke out loud, and all hell broke loose. Because why is all this negativity and curse words on the walls of the Whitney Museum? And someone else would say, "Don't you like Richard Pryor?" I'm like, "Yeah, I love Richard Pryor at home, not on the museum walls." And so this idea of like what can be said and enjoyed in private versus what was being, you know, aired in public, the dirty laundry, you know? And
do you like that challenge, though? Do you like that comes out?
It was fascinating because on several levels. One, because, like, that's what artists do, air the dirty laundry. But also the idea that the museum professional is pushed aside and the audience member comes up and then they have this debate in front of the painting. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's remarkable.
And you were talking about Thelma Golden, you came up with a term, post-blackness.
Ooh.
Is this, no, we don't. This no is something
good
that
term goes unpunished.
Well, that was something that you conceived together. Is that something that?
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of me trying to find a way to talk about artists who I think trying to describe a generational split between artists of my generation or an earlier generation who had a certain notion about how Blackness could be portrayed and seen, and a younger generation that just didn't come with those kinds of assumptions on many different levels, that Blackness needed to be figurative, that Blackness needed to address the community, in quotes, you know, air quotes, that there were, you know, proper ways to address Black folks and improper ways to address it. And just noticing that there is a generation of artists, and here I was talking about people like Julie Moretti or Mark Bradford or, you know, who are quite famous, well-known names now, but thinking about like how deeply invested their work was in Black culture, but also deeply invested in abstraction and materiality and all these other issues. And so my sort of jokey shorthand for them is like, you know, to Thelma, it's like, oh, another show with all your post-Black children, you know, in it. And it sort of stuck as a way to describe this sort of generational shift. And it's funny to me when you say things like that and they turn into things that are out in the world that people cite and write dissertations about or whatever.
Because you said it quite offhand. You said it quite like...
Yeah, in some ways offhand, but Thelma's brilliance is to recognize that that's a useful term, you know, and to sort of, you know, bring it into to the discourse, you know, in a productive way and let other people run with it, debate it, etc., you know?
Yeah.
You know, there's I heard you speaking before about this idea of unofficial Glenn and official Glenn. So the idea that like the works from the 80s are maybe prior to the work that you became well known for, in a sense. And when you were still making like abstract expressionist kind of influenced paintings. And I really loved the one that got included in the retrospective you had that has text from kind of gay porn magazines. I think it says, "I don't really know why" is the first sentence in that one. The way that you've got like a very explicitly kind of abstract or abex kind of gesture at the bottom of the painting and then text at the top. And it got me thinking a lot about your later work when you were using stencils like Russell just referenced, where you were doing it on the doors in PS1 when you were there. And you had the text that kind of starts off very clear and then as it goes on, it disintegrates and kind of becomes abstract. And I think that is a really fascinating part of your work. You know, you're talking about this offhand kind of post-Black artists who were making abstraction, whereas your work had kind of text within it. But I think you do cross this kind of this territory of like where words are present, but also they become disintegrated in a sense.
Manipulated in some ways.
Right.
Yeah. And also that kind of repetition and persistence. I love those two particular words in that context I heard you say before. Can you speak a bit about that?
Yeah, those earlier things are kind of like, you know, the pre-Glenn works, you know, because everyone thinks, you know, my work is black and white text paintings. But there's work that's before that that uses quotation, like all my text paintings do. But the quotation was from, like, porn magazines, you know, stories from porn magazines scrawled in pencil into these kind of abstract expressionist fields. So that was my transition from, like, oh, I'm a fifth generation abstract expressionist to, oh, I'm an artist that uses text. That was the sort of line between them when I was trying to figure out, like, how do I incorporate, you know, it's funny to say it, too, you know, I've been laughing because I was like going to say, how do I incorporate the things I was reading into my work? I was like, yeah, I was sitting at home reading porn magazines. So like, how do you...
And then highlighting the sections you enjoyed. Yeah, right. Got it. Yeah.
Art, you know, how do I get that into my work? Which I guess makes more sense if you're talking about, you know, a text quoting, you know, Zora Neale Hurston or Ralph Ellison or whatever. But the earlier work was, from those porn magazines. And it was a really a way, you know, and we were talking before about me not using my handwriting. Those were in my handwriting. So
right.
But they weren't my text, you know, like, so they were using my handwriting. So one would assume, oh, that's Glenn writing this text, but they were
like diaristic or something there. Yeah.
And I moved to stencils because I didn't want that element in it, you know, like, I didn't want people to think like, oh, that's Glenn writing. It's like, no, that's James Baldwin. Glenn can't write like that, you know. But also I was interested in, obviously, artists like Jasper Johns who'd use stencils, you know. Way of distancing, you know.
Right, it acts as a distance, the stencil.
Between myself and the text that was being used was important there. And, you know, in terms of like text starting out clear and disappearing in those early paintings, you know, often I find that the problem I'm trying to solve is the best part of the work. So the problem I was trying to solve is like, how do you make paintings using stencils and paint and not make them all messy? Because if you put oil paint through stencils, it's all messy. The letters don't keep their shape, you know? So I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to make them clean and nice. And then I realized, oh, the fact that they make all these messy marks and they kind of smudge and smear is the most interesting thing.
Yeah.
And often I find like the mistakes, you know, the things I'm trying to like get rid of, often become the things that are the most important things, you know.
Right.
Where,
but you use oil stick, don't you, as well? Yeah. Like the oil paint you end up, yeah, oil stick.
Yeah. Yeah, which is basically like, you know, using a giant oil crayon through a stencil. But the oil picks up on the back of the stencil. So you make a letter with oil paint, you move the stencil over, make another letter, but the oil paint from the first letter smudges when you're trying to make the second letter. And that's what I was trying to fix. And then I realized like, no, don't fix that. That's the work.
Embrace that.
And it's such a nice connection to Reich, like we were talking about earlier about the sound piece, where the samples end up kind of merging and becoming a noise. Right. Like I always think of that kind of work you make as a visual representation
like
of that somehow.
Yeah.
Or even someone that I know you admire, Felix Gonzalez Torres, like Russell's favorite piece of the two clocks that are slightly out of sync with each
two
other.
Lovers.
And that show you did in Nottingham that you curated that had his work in it. But like, I don't know, it's interesting to somehow have been able to encapsulate that in a visual context, you know, a bit.
You
like
know, Robert, you're very clever because it took me literally decades to realize that Steve Reich's composition Come Out had some relationship to my work. It seems so obvious now, but it literally took me decades. Like, wait, he's quoting a text. It goes to abstraction through repetition. Hello, that's my work, you know?
But, is there a double meaning with the title, Come Out, as well?
No. I mean, there is for me.
That's what I mean. For you personally, is that like...
Autobiographically.
Is there like the queer kind of phrase, come out?
Yeah, you know? That's the slippery, you know, slipperiness of language, that those meanings always... There's always other meanings, you know?
And that's also different depending on who's viewing it. Because for me and Russell, we're both queer. So when we see that, that's the first thing we think.
Yeah.
Probably.
Oh, you're going to
like,
coming out.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
Language. Can I quickly say one more thing? So Russell referenced your ceramics when you were a kid. And there was a show you did in Tokyo. And I never knew this body of work until we researched this episode. But the moon jars.
Oh, yeah.
And that body of work. Can you speak a bit about that? Because I'd never even knew
you did that.
The sculptural vessels.
Yeah, there was... I'll give you the short version of it. They were a long time in gestation, but I had a show maybe seven, almost 8 years ago in Tokyo at this fantastic gallery called Rat Hole, a little tiny gallery. And the people that ran it, Caroline Elder and Osamu Wataya, we just kind of like, you know, got along really well. And so much so that when they had a son, Luca, his middle name is Glenn.
Really?
Yeah. So anyway, I did a show with them maybe 8 years ago, and we just kind of fell in love with each other. And I fell in love with Luca when he was born. And so every year I'd go to Japan to visit, or they would come to New York. And we got really interested in Japanese ceramics and started visiting, you know, the Raku Museum in Kyoto and things like that. And sort of over time got the idea that maybe I'd want to make ceramics. But the form that I was particularly interested in was not Japanese, it was Korean. These things called moon jars, these big white porcelain jars. Incredible works. But we found a ceramicist in Japan who's Korean born, but lived in Japan for 30 years and made moon jars. And so it took us about 2 years, you know, of working back and forth with him, trying to persuade him that he could make black moon jars, you know, which is the opposite of the work he was making, making him use different clay, you know, different glazes. Me kind of directing, you know, sometimes going to Japan to, you know, see the things directly as they were being made, and sometimes just looking at images and saying like, oh, that one's nice, but why don't we try more, you know, this pigment? Why don't you try firing at a higher temperature? Why don't, you know, but also realizing that when you're collaborating with someone, they have a way of doing things, and they go for perfection, but I wasn't interested in perfection. So he showed me one day this pot he had made that sort of partially collapsed, and he was going to throw it on the trash heap. And I was like, that's the best one you've made. But I couldn't say that to him, because then he would start trying to make what he thought I wanted rather than experimenting, you know? So this is, I find collaboration really interesting, because it's always this tricky back and forth working with fabricators when they think that they know what you want, and that's when the stuff isn't good. It's like, no, I want the accident.
How did you navigate that and make a show of them then? Did you just he must have seen all the accidents in the show and thought, what?
I'm sure he was mortified, but you know, we just sort of like psyched him out actually. I was like, no, just keep everything. We'll sort it out later. You know, I was like, the one I like the best is the one you were about to throw out, you know? But yeah, we just kept making them until it got enough. So I thought they could be a show, and showed them about a year or so ago, a little bit more than a year ago, in Tokyo Rat Hall. That the gallery is since closed. They're on to other projects. But we're going to show them in New York, you know, sooner or later. It was super, super fun to sort of work on, and got me thinking about a lot of other projects. But it's also, you know, thinking about them, they are, in a way, quotation, you know, in a way they're akin to other things that I've done, in that they're taking a form that exists and using it in a different way, making black moon jars instead of white ceramic, you know, white porcelain moon jars, you know. So taking this form and tweaking it, or pushing the idea of what it can be.
Yeah.
I've always loved the title moon jar as well. There's something so kind of simple and poetic about space. It, like moon jar. Yeah. It sounds like, you know, it somehow encapsulates or protects the universe or something.
I think it sounds like Star Trek. It's always like where they keep their kind of visors.
Anyway, I really hope I get to see that series, because I didn't even know you'd done that, and they're fascinating and beautiful objects. Yeah. So.
I've got a serious question for you, Glenn. I want to talk about something. Your Gap adverts and appearing in the J. Crew catalogues. Yeah. What's that about?
Oh, that's all about charity, Russell. Come on.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, the Gap was making donations to various charities. So if you gave them an image for a t-shirt and sat for the ad, that ad is embarrassing, because I've got the t-shirt pulled over my head and it was on billboards, and I hate being photographed. And so the photographers were very good, but ugh, yikes, hate being photographed.
Well, we ask every guest two questions. One of those questions is, Russ?
If you could do an art heist, Glenn, if you could have any work of art in the world, whatever it is, from wherever, what would it be and why?
Oh, my God.
We can help you as well. We can bring trucks or cranes.
Because you collect, don't you?
I do collect. I would say, you know, high on top of my wish list right now, and I'm just putting this out in the universe, is a Basquiat head drawing. He did amazing drawings of heads on paper. I'd take a painting too, but I think that the paper ones are particularly beautiful. So, you know, If the universe wants me to have one, it's out in the world now. So definitely.
Wow.
Good times.
Who else do you collect? Who else have you got in your collection? Do you have any Basquiat?
I have, let's see, David Hammond's, Beaufort Delaney. David Hammond. When I can afford. Let's see. I would love a Twombly. I would love a de Kooning. Yes. I'm just going mentally through my head. Zoe Leonard. That's a hard question. I'm blanking, but you know, I basically collect things that I feel like I can learn from, you know, or I'm jealous of.
I'm really grateful actually to you because you mentioned in a lecture that you gave about Downtown 81, the film which Basquiat features in. And I used to hang out a bit with Maripol, who was partly behind that film. She was a stylist and photographer or whatever in the 80s. But I'd totally forgotten about that film. And that film had such a big impact on me way before I even really realized I was into art. It's such an extraordinary film and a kind of document of New York at that time.
It's super interesting to see that period because that's the period I grew up in. You know, I was in New York in the 80s. Yeah. I'd moved to, you know, to Brooklyn then, you know, another one of those things. My mother's like, why are you moving to Brooklyn? It's dangerous. Like, we live in the South Bronx, which is considered the most dangerous neighborhood in the world. So I think I'll be fine in Fort Greene, but whatever. Again, she didn't know anyone. We didn't know anybody there. So it was all about like proximity to folks who could got your back, you know. But yeah, New York was a very interesting place at that moment, you know. And it's interesting to think about, you know, Basquiat, you know, the graffiti crews that he ran with, you know, and how they influenced his work, you know. He ran with a crew. He didn't run solo, you know. And so that's super interesting. Yeah. You see that in those movies, you know.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Did Richard Pryor ever know that you were using his words for work and everything? Was he aware of it?
You know, somebody said that he knew a little bit about my work, but I don't think he was alive when I started doing those paintings. Yeah. But I would love to have met him.
Yeah, absolutely. My God. There was that generation just of like comedians that just changed the game.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The other question we ask every guest is a very simple one. What is your favorite color?
Well, I guess the obvious one would be black, but really, I've got a lot of blue. You know, this is a Thelma wrote an essay once for a catalog. And she talked about, you know, the thing that we call each other on the phone and talk about men shopping and the art world, not necessarily in that order. And she's like, yeah, I can just picture Glenn buying another blue shirt. And it's true.
You have a lot of blue shirts.
Kind of blues, you know, endless varieties of blue. So,
is there a particular shade of blue that you like?
I like dark blue, you know, not navy, kind of darker, almost, you know, blue black. That was the name of an exhibition I curated for the Pulitzer Foundation in St. Louis, blue black. So yeah, things in that range.
What are you reading right now?
Oh my God, another hard question.
Sorry, we've got J.
He's reading
Crew
Netflix.
Books.
He's reading the Netflix inventory.
Yeah. Oh my God, what am I reading right now? Afro-pessimism. That's the book I'm reading by James Wilderson. Though it's a headbanger, so I got to read it slowly.
Uh-huh. Mm. Amazing. Great.
And for someone who's got such a sort of, you've had this very strong long-term kind of career, you know, longevity, I guess.
Right.
What advice would you give to young artists? Only because we get asked a lot on Instagram by a lot of the young artists, can you ask, you know, some of these leading artists what advice you would give to a younger artist or your younger self even?
Well, first of all, let me correct Frank Wilderson. got his name wrong. Afro-pessimism, amazing book. But younger artists, I would say that one, this might sound harsh, but it's kind of true. Nobody cares as much about your work as you do. So you gotta really care about what you're putting out in the world. And you gotta sweat all the details, you know, because I cannot tell you how many times I thought, oh, we'll just let that go. And then you go to the museum and it's hanging upside down, you know?
No.
Literally, you know?
Oh, my God. Do you find it hard to sell work? Do you feel quite attached to everything you make?
No, I want the work to circulate because it's about ideas. So the object is just a way to circulate ideas. Yeah. You know, there are things I've certainly kept because I find, well, that's another thing I would say for younger artists. Keep the things that are generative of new possibilities in your own work. Because sometimes people think, like, because you can sell something, you should. I'm like, no. I went to a show of Jasper Johns at a gallery here in New York, and I just looked at the labels, and so many of them were collection of the artists, and I was like, okay, he knew from the beginning, keep important work, because the $5 somebody's going to give you for that painting now, you will regret that for the rest of your life, because at a certain point, you know, I mean, I'm at the point where I can't afford to buy back my own work, you know?
And do you, from auctions and stuff?
I can't afford it.
Oh, you can't afford it?
Can't afford it. So I think there are things that I wish I'd kept. And there certainly are some things that I kept, you know, from early on. But there are a lot more things I wish I'd kept.
Does that blow your mind, though, that your practice now, the work you put out, that you can't afford to buy back yourself?
Yeah, it's bizarre. It's bizarre. But again, it's not for me, you know, I'd still be doing this if it were just like piles of stuff in the basement. I'd still be making the work, you know. I'm just, you know, fortunate that the work circulates in the world and people respond to it. And, you know, scholar friends write about it. Yeah. And people go see it in various places. So I feel like it's kind of amazing, you know. I'm getting a little teary just thinking about, you know, my mom and her kind of like, why do you want to be an artist? But she kind of set this all up for me, you know? Oh. Anyway.
That's amazing. So what's next? So we've got the Grief and Grievance show.
And that runs until the 6th of June.
Yes. Yeah. And then where can we see your work next?
Next shows are both with Hauser & Wirth Gallery.
Who you signed with last year, right? 2019. Yeah.
Zurich in September of next year, and then New York in November. This year. Oh my God. Yikes.
This year, 2021.
Yeah, 21. See, I was giving
November this year at Hauser & Wirth in New York.
Yeah, end of this year, Hauser & Wirth in New York, and September in Zurich and Hauser & Wirth.
And you're making that work now, right?
Yes. Yes, I am making that work now. So
can't wait.
Wishing you all the best for that. And I really hope we get to come to New York to your opening.
Oh, I hope so too. But
hopefully by November we'll be.
Or you come to the UK, because you've had so many things here in the UK with the Camden Arts Centre, and we talk about Nottingham. It feels like the UK is quite important to you.
And actually, I guess we live in the UK, don't we? But I was about to say, I first discovered your work through Juro Alawu and also Laurie Fitch.
Oh, yeah.
Very close friend. Yep. They were the two people that kept mentioning your work to me that initially made me look at your work about 8 years ago or so.
Yeah, Juro, amazing designer, but also an amazing curator, and Laurie, an amazing collector and friend. So great. But I always think of London as like intellectual boot camp when I first started coming to London, you know, in the early 90s, I met people like Isaac Julian and Stuart Hall. And, you know, I just thought, oh, my God, it's like boot camp. You know, we are just so far behind all this stuff in New York. You know, I better get myself in shape. You know?
Wow,
so London has amazing. A special, you know, place in my heart.
Well, I can't wait till Stuart we Hall can go like? There and you can come here. Yeah, Stuart Hall. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, having dinner with Stuart Hall, you know, I was like, oh, this is how it works over here.
Amazing.
Well, everyone listening.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Glenn.
All right. It's been such a privilege to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Please stick around because we've got to upload this. But for everyone listening, go to our Talk Art page and we can put up images of what we've been talking about today. Glenn, are you on Instagram? Are you on social media?
Yeah, Instagram under my own name.
Wow.
I know, bizarre.
Do you enjoy Instagram? Is that something you embrace?
Well, for the first couple of months, I've just put up pictures of cute owls and like bunnies.
Love owls.
One said you had to pick a theme. And people were like, oh, somebody hacked your name and is using it because they're just pictures of owls. I'm like, that's me.
Why owls? Because I'm obsessed with owls. I've been talking a lot about it recently. The emoji owl is my favorite emoji.
Well, if you go back in my first post, it's all like turtles and owls and bunnies.
Yes, Glenn.
And then I started posting about, you know, stuff that I saw that I liked. So
cool. And you can also visit glennligonstudio.com. And
the new museum.
You will see an incredible archive there of work and installations. And thank you to the new museum.
Yes.
And we'll be back very soon. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks. Stick around, Glenn. Cheers.
Bye, Glenn.
Okay, bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.